trusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
Comply. How you going, man?
Oh, I'm really happy to be on your show. And man, you have had some terrific guests over the last couple of months. This is only my second podcast, so I really feel like I'm in august company, and I'm very much grateful for your invitation.
Hey, man, it's my pleasure. And it wouldn't actually. I think I might have glimpsed come up on my queue on Fountain App for Bitcoin Rapid Fire. I think you're on John Vallis's pod, and for whatever reason, life got in the way, and so I missed out on listening to it when I first saw it. But a guest that we had on recently, my boy Atlas Hoddled, he reached out to me before he actually. Before I asked him to be on the pod, and he suggested that I have you as a guest, so we can thank Atlas Hoddled for bringing you to my attention again, which is really cool.
Well, I am sincerely grateful, in part because I think getting started in the Bitcoin, I've been into Bitcoin for 5-6 years now, more than that, I guess. I bought my first Bitcoin at the beginning of 2015. This essay I just released this past spring was my very first contribution to the Bitcoin world, apart from orange pilling some of my friends and family. And one thing I'm really sure about is, you know, since I've been into this for a while, I feel like had I written something like this 4 or 5 years ago, it would have been really easy to establish an audience for it. But now the Bitcoin world is so crowded with voices that if you're starting from scratch with a new Twitter account and a pseudonym, boy, it is... It's all but impossible to get anybody's attention. I was so grateful that John Vallis had me on, and Gigi was the first person to tweet about my essay. And I've had a couple of other accounts tweet about it. But boy, it is really tough sledding in 2023 to start from scratch.
You talk about some esteemed company. I mean, you got, you know, Vallis, who we've had on, thankfully. I've been very cool and grateful to have Vallis on, I think, episode 9. And Gigi, I was pestering him to try and be on episode 21, but he's very busy with his new book. But to have those two in your court is pretty phenomenal, man. So I actually wanted to do something a little out of the ordinary before I ask you the first question. And you mentioned the essay that you wrote. And it's not an essay. It's kind of like a beginner's guide to Bitcoin. I mean, it's called Bitcoin Basics, Key Information for Beginners. And I'll make sure that I put the link in the show notes so that anyone listening can go and read it, because as I was saying to you off air, I was rereading, I was trying to reread it this afternoon, squeeze it in with all the other things going on. But the intro, it's just such a compelling way to start talking about Bitcoin. And it's difficult to talk about Bitcoin, and it's difficult to talk about it in a really basic 101 understanding, particularly if you've dove fairly deep down the rabbit hole. And you kind of forget what it's like to be a beginner. But what I wanted to do is just quickly read one of the paragraphs from the intro, if I may.
Oh, please.
So you write, learning about Bitcoin is never a drag. Bitcoin is fucking cool. It's the most fascinating technology I've ever encountered, and digging further into Bitcoin is always rewarding. Because of the crazy variety of fields it intersects with and draws from, economics, computer science, game theory, etc., I've always suspected it was introduced by extraterrestrials or benevolent AI. But enough with the crazy talk or the sincerely held belief. Let's dive in. You're right, man. Bitcoin is fucking cool, and it is one of the most intellectually stimulating things I've ever encountered myself. And I remember thinking that when I first got orange pilled or fell down the rabbit hole, whatever. And just reading that paragraph earlier this afternoon just reminded me of that moment. So I want to ask you, how did you discover Bitcoin?
Well, I had read about it once or twice on Slashdot shortly after it came out. I was still reading Slashdot back in the day, and kind of dismissed it as yet another scheme. But it kind of smelled like there was something to it. But I had no idea how I could pin a value on it or whatever. It just seemed like speculation and so forth. And then I was, I guess, a couple of years after that, we're talking about the end of 2014. I was out. I decided to go to Maui for a while. I was staying. I rented a room at a friend's house. And one afternoon, I was just sort of hanging out and smoking dope and decided I wanted to listen to a Joe Rogan podcast. And, you know, you open up the thing and you see the last 10 names or whatever. And who should I, you know, what guest should I listen to? And they had this guy with this really funny name, Andreas Antonopoulos. I'm like, wow, you know, so just on the strength of him having an unusual name, I was like, what's this all about? And as many of you guys know, he was one of the earliest people to really carry water for Bitcoin and explain it to people. There's that wonderfully famous clip now of him trying to speak to an audience in 2012 or whatever, and it's a big room with a couple hundred chairs and there's like three people there. So I mean, I mean Bitcoin, I think the path of Bitcoin and its adoption was forever changed because of Andreas Antonopoulos, and particularly because of the three shows he did with Rogan. I'm so grateful to Joe for having him on three times, and I wish he had brought him back after 2015. In any event, I'm not the most technical guy, but you know, I do understand the basics of public key cryptography. I do understand the basics of game theory. I do understand the basics of coding. I do understand the basics of macroeconomics. Like, I had, you know, a working knowledge of all those things, and all sort of in the realm of being a dilettante, but a working knowledge nevertheless. And I think that for me, within 20 minutes of listening to Andreas pitch the very basics, everything snapped together in my head a lot more quickly than for most other people. And I just felt like I got it right away. And I mean, I really made the decision by the time I was done listening to that first podcast that I would take my my life savings and just throw it into Bitcoin.
Holy shit.
So I did. And
just say that again, because I heard you say it and I'm just not, I mean, yeah, you just went balls deep straight up.
Yeah, I mean, I would never go to Las Vegas. I mean, willingly. I went for a bachelor party once and I hated every moment of it because I would never. I just think that gambling, any form of gambling in Vegas, unless you are a supremely gifted poker player or possibly a blackjack player, everything is against you. And I think gambling when the odds are against you has to be the stupidest thing in the world. But if you, if I know for a fact that I have an 80% chance of winning on a bet that pays 50-50, I'm going to bet all day. You know, that's the, you know, and to me, that's not gambling. That's just being intelligent.
No.
And I won't say that I thought that Bitcoin had an 80% chance of success, because I don't think it did back then. This was before the block wars and all that, but the block size wars. But I felt like it had a better than even chance. And Bitcoin was then going for barely a tenth the price of an ounce of gold. And I knew, you know, roughly that there was basically an ounce of gold for everybody on the planet, but there were only 21 million Bitcoin to be spread out over 8 billion people. So, you know, it's just like Bitcoin is just incomparably rarer than gold. And we can get into other nuances of that. But many of your readers already get that. But, you know, I realized, hey, you know, if I bought just 21 million Bitcoin at under 300 bucks, if I bought 21 Bitcoin at under 300 bucks a piece, I would forever own one millionth of the supply in a world that has 8 billion people. So, you know, that just seemed like a pretty obvious thing to do. And so like the, you know, I felt like, I felt like this. Who's the person who first used the term asymmetric bet? Maybe that's Foss. I don't know. But you know, Bitcoin, especially 6-7 years ago, was the ultimate asymmetric bet. And hey, you know, I will never go to Vegas, but give me an asymmetric bet, and I will be there every time.
You ran the numbers, sir, and the you know, you did the due diligence. I love the fact that you just listened to that one episode. I mean, you know, that's just nuts. That's so cool.
I got it. You know, the you know, and since then my understanding has deepened, and I won't say that, you know, I had a totally nuanced understanding of everything from day one. I certainly won't claim that. I ended up throwing away some money on Litecoin in 2017 because I, you know, at the height of the block size wars and all that. So I am certainly fallible. But on the other hand, I have never sold a Satoshi. And as time went by, I threw a little money into a little more of my money that I earned, and I threw it into MicroStrategy, so I would have another pile of Bitcoin exposure apart from the Bitcoin that I was self custodying. So I mean, there are certainly people who understand Bitcoin a lot better than me, but I am very much a maximalist. I am very much a hodler, and I have never gotten rid of any of my precious Satoshis other than to give away some to somebody I regard as a brother.
Nice. Well, they say everybody buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve, and that sounds cold and harsh and mean to a person unfamiliar with Bitcoin, but man, you got it at the price you deserve. Fair play. That's very cool.
I don't know that I agree that everybody gets it at the price they deserve. I think a much more productive message than that is that if you are still on zero, if anybody listening to this still has zero Bitcoin, what the hell are you doing? Like, that is the only thing I'm sure about is that given the risk reward, given the current state of Bitcoin and its life cycle, I mean, Bitcoin could still fail tomorrow. I think the chances are very remote, thanks to the Lindy effect, but which is another thing I cover in my essay. But I think that it, how much does it have to go up for the market cap of Bitcoin to be equal to the market cap of gold? I think it's still like a 20 times. Increase.
It's a lot.
And I think, I think that Bitcoin just objectively trumps gold, 17 out of 20 ways. And it's just a vastly superior asset to gold, whether you self-custody it or get it through a spot ETF that is working well. I just think that and I think those spot ETFs are within months of approval. I'm sure it's going to get approved, as sure as I can be. So I mean, if I have one message for any no-coiners listening to this, is like the best use of your time right now, the very best use of your time is, commit to spending at least 15, 20 minutes a day reading about Bitcoin, and make sure you're using good sources. Like another thing that I really sought to do in this guide I wrote is to just warn people about all the snakes and charlatans who are, basically affiliate scammers who say good things about Bitcoin, but are really trying to sell you on their lending business or their altcoin or their NFT or whatever BS they're trying to pitch. I think it's real. I mention a few people in my essay who I think have total integrity. And I would say start following them on Twitter, start reading their stuff. And then from there, only pay attention to the people they are interacting with. And you just got to watch yourself, because, Bitcoin is so valuable that it attracts a lot of scammers. And you just have to really make sure from the get-go that you only plug into people who are coming from an ethically pure place.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone's a scammer, right? Michael Goldstein wrote about that. Long time ago, and everyone's trying to get your Bitcoin, as you mentioned it, at the time of the recording, the gold market cap versus Bitcoin is 4.6%, which is tiny, tiny, tiny.
Well, I said 20 to 1. That was a pretty, pretty good, off the shelf estimate. So, I mean, that's just, whether it's 5% or 10% or 20%, it's way undervalued in comparison to gold. And the fact is that not only should Bitcoin eclipse gold as a store of value, it should in many respects eclipse real estate and stocks as a form of value. Let's get into that for a moment.
I can't wait for it to eat real estate. I really can't.
Well, it's like, I have never owned a house. I have never owned real estate. And there's the silver bug, Mike Maloney. He has one of my all-time favorite macroeconomics quotes. He said, I'm paraphrasing him, but paraphrasing him really closely, that, you can never truly own real estate. If you think you can truly own real estate, try buying some and then not paying your taxes for a few years and see what happens. and then on top of that, you've got homeowners associations, you've got, tenants who are probably cooking up meth in your garage, whatever. There's just so many ways, you've got home repairs, you've just got so many ways that you're just throwing money into the abyss. You're paying property taxes. So your actual true rate of return in real estate, it's been unfairly good over the last 40 years, thanks largely to the continuing decline of interest rates since the Volcker era. But those days are over, and now we're seeing, for the first time, property valuations beginning to crater in cities around the world. And I think we're going to see a lot more pain to come where real estate is concerned. You could not pay me to invest in real estate. And then let's think about stocks. Stocks, when you own stocks, you're owning a portion of a business. And go have a look at the top 10, 20, 100 companies in the 1970s and compare that list to today. A lot of those companies are out of business. And if you had owned stocks in them, they would have trended to zero. And what's to say that's not going to happen with the stocks, with the top 10, 20, 100 stocks that exist today? It's the exact same thing. On top of that, the PE ratios are just completely out of whack. I mean, I just have to think, what are you thinking if you're just buying index fund, committing a substantial portion of your wealth to any sort of stock ETF index fund? It's just insane. And to think that anybody has the talent to actually come out ahead picking stocks, you really have to be like at the card counter, professional poker player level if you think you can get ahead of the market doing that. So stocks suck. And then you look at bonds, and shoot, I'm not even going to go there. If you're interested in why bonds are just a complete disaster, Greg Foss is your guy. He's been, as he says, in a risk chair for 35 years and knows risk inside out. And listen to any podcast with him, and he'll tell you why bonds are just a train wreck. And we can expect, you can be sure that you're going to lose money if you're investing in bonds these days. So the entire 60-40 portfolio of keeping your money in a way that's simultaneously safe and going to stay ahead of inflation, those days are done. So what does that leave us with? It leaves us with things that are genuinely scarce, like precious metals and Bitcoin, which is the scarcest asset that's ever existed.
He just laid out a fairly bullish case, and anybody that hasn't, as you said at the top, gotten off zero. I mean, if you're listening to Discovering Bitcoin and you're still on zero, that's actually absolutely fine, because that's part of the intention of the pod, is to sort of encourage people to fall down the rabbit hole. But just sort your life out. Otherwise, you're not going to make it. Why do you think that you were open and able to discovering Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, I think it was mostly that, like, I think the two things I was kind of really interested in high school was macroeconomics and computer programming. I was, I was at a pretty swanky high-end high school that had a room of Apple IIs back in the days, back when most school districts couldn't afford them, and an Apple II would set you back a couple grand. So I was lucky enough to, be able to take some, very basic computer classes. I was lucky enough, or I was smart enough anyway, to buy a Commodore 64 during my senior year of high school and do some programming on that. Programming in the basic programming language, even something that minimalist and that high level, I think it rewires your brain. It forces you to think in a really sequential way. And if you have any experience doing any amount of programming, even in a simple, high-level, rudimentary language like BASIC or Pascal or God forbid, Fortran, all of which I've spent a little time with, you know, it will rewire your brain and give you an appreciation for, you know, how things run in the world of computers. And you know, so like right there, just knowing about the power of programming or even the power of scripting, hey, you can appreciate that if you can take that. And then if you also understand public key and encryption, you know, public and private keys, and how that works, you could imagine then just setting up a script where everybody on the network has a public key and a private key, and they can then just transfer tokens on the network around using the equivalent of, well, not email because it's a public ledger, but I mean, you those basic concepts are there, and then from there, I mean, the mining of Bitcoin using basically a coordinated network that tries to attack and find the answer to this elliptical curve problem. Hey, that's not that hard of a thing to figure out. And then you could just, you know, do a difficulty adjustment as more, make the equation ever more, have ever more answers and thus require ever more computing power. Like, you know, that's not that big of a stretch if you already know the basics of scripting, you already know the basics of public key cryptography, you already know the basics of game theory. So I already knew that stuff. And I've had an appreciation since the early 1980s, the Reagan era, of the national debt just spiking, you know, to undreamed of levels. I could see the trend we were on. And I was doing things like reading Wealth of Nations when I was 17 years old and Das Kapital and, you know, just getting up to speed on the essentials of competing economic systems. So like I kind of came with, you know, as I said earlier, sort of as a dilettante in all those areas. I certainly couldn't, you know, write my own, you know, pretty good privacy protocol or any of that. Or I certainly didn't have the coding chops of Satoshi or any of that, but I had enough to connect the dots and to imagine, you know, and to know that if I had the coding chops and if I had a deep understanding of cryptography, if I had, you know, I could just sort of assemble different components of Bitcoin off the shelf and it would work. And knowing that it had been working at that stage for the past 5 years, that was already enough of a Lindy effect to feel like, hey, if it's gone 5 years, it's likely to go 10. If it goes 10 years, it's probably going to go 100. So that was kind of my thought process. So yeah, I definitely feel like in my own lazy way, I was sort of specially equipped to understand things a lot quicker. But you could say that about anybody. I mean, you know, we could go back to Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs, as a 19-year-old, an 18-year-old, was at Reed College taking a calligraphy course. And it's like, you dork, what's the use of somebody like you studying calligraphy? Are you kidding me? What a waste of time, you could say in the most stupidly judgmental way imaginable. But then it turns out that a few years after that, they start developing the Macintosh. And wow, everything he learned about fonts by taking calligraphy made him appreciate the incredible value proposition of what being able to adjust fonts and type size and all that would bring if you could just do these things on a computer. And so, it wasn't time wasted any more than my time reading Das Kapital or coding in a typing computer on Apple's basic language using shapes and color to create sprites, or I don't even know if they were sprites. But anyway, you know, the point is that none of this is time wasted. And you know, as long as you're like strive for brain plasticity and getting into a whole bunch of fields that interest you when you're young, it's going to pay off by the time you're middle-aged.
Yeah, totally. And you know, like, let a thousand flowers bloom, so to speak. It's one of the things that I have a lot of, I guess, hope for with respect to the success of Bitcoin, whatever that looks like, hyper-Bitcoinization, whatever, the ability for individuals to pursue whatever interests them, to go out and play, just like we're encouraged to do as kids, you know, because that's where the learning happens, not behind a desk in front of a teacher teaching you whatever it is. It's being out in the world on an adventure, playing with friends and doing that sort of thing. And so if you can bring that into the adult realm and pursue play in whatever interest it is, whether it's calligraphy, cryptography, music, whatever, you know, these are valuable things in and of themselves. It's just that they're not valued under a fiat standard, which preferences, I don't know, the hamster wheel over everything else, really.
Yeah, you know, the greatest value you have is not what's in your bank account. Your greatest value is your brain plasticity, and also your lack of limiting beliefs. You know, it's like, it's really important, I think, to just know that it's possible for your life to change in a very short amount of time. And I hope I'm not sounding like Tony Robbins here, but, you know, it's like...
wouldn't be a bad thing if you were, to be honest, man. He's got some good pointers, you know?
No, he does. He does. I think his books are well worth reading. And I think that there's much to be gained out of reading his first couple of books. But there's people who I think are higher integrity, like Steve Pavlina in particular. He is, I think, the highest integrity personal productivity guru. He really comes from a good place. I have no connection with him, by the way, other than I had one positive interaction with him. But just as an aside, like, you know, when I was right about 40, I was, which was more than 15 years ago, I was really poor. And I'd spent most of my adult life being poor after growing up in a very upper middle class environment. And I, you know, it wasn't like I was poor because I was lazy. It was because I was just trying to do good things for the world, and those things didn't really pay. And, you know, I mean, I've spent years of my life living in places that were cold and not really having the money to heat them adequately. And, you know, I mean, just really living kind of on the fringe. And, you know, when I was 40, I was like, you know, I'm a lot smarter than people who have a lot more money than me. And, and I got to take the responsibility here. Like, this is on me for not figuring this out. And so I was like, you know, what am I doing wrong? And so at that point, I just every day made a point of sitting down on a cushion for my first 15 minutes every morning, 15, 20 minutes, and just thinking about ways I could improve my life. And every time I got an idea, I'd write it down on an index card. And over the next month, I got a bunch of good ideas. I'd go through my index cards and I'd pick out the very best ideas and I'd start implementing them. And from that point, it was like my life diverged, and it's been on this incredible upward path ever since. And it's all because, like, it took me until I was 40 to realize that, like, you know, you have a brain, use it, you know, use it to, like, figure out, like, how you can best contribute to the world in a way where you don't have to live in poverty. Anyway, so that happened a good 10 years plus before I really got into Bitcoin, but it was key to me amassing enough money that my Bitcoin investment wasn't trivial. And then it's been just all happy things ever since. So sorry for that tangent. And now
that was a great tangent. That was a really fucking cool tangent, because I don't know, it's just a nice little bit of insight, because as you were saying, you probably, I don't know, I'm inferring here, but you're pursuing things that made you, that gave you satisfaction, I suppose, but perhaps didn't pay very well or whatever. I don't know, whatever the aversion is. I mean, yeah, you see it all the time. There's loads of people intellectually compromised making far more money.
Yeah, I was doing activism, but I viewed the nonprofit world as being just utterly bogus. And I still do. I mean, God forbid I have to give my money away. I wouldn't know how to even do that, because I think, I just look at the financials of how most nonprofits are being run, and I am just filled with contempt.
Burn your sats. That's a really good way of making a contribution. Just burn them. Send them.
Yeah, well,
send
them to the Michael Saylor route. Yeah. And he's serious, and we are so lucky to have that guy.
I agree. So yeah, Saylor's I don't know. I don't fanboy over Saylor. I mean, he says a lot of intelligent, insightful things. I just check myself before I get all giddy.
I put it like this. I mean, I don't have heroes, but yeah, would I ever love to have a beer with that guy or Andreas for that matter? But in my eyes, I just feel like both Andreas and Saylor, I think those are the two people who brought their own gifts to the world, and each of them have sped up the adoption of Bitcoin by at least a year over what it otherwise would be. And, I think one of the most important thoughts within Bitcoin, and I don't think I mentioned this, I mentioned Corey Clipson in my guide, but I'm not sure if I mentioned one of his great points, and that's we are in a race. You know, it's like, for us to get to Bitcoin hyper Bitcoinization in 15 years is not twice as good as doing it in 30 years. It's 100 times better, because you know the quicker we can establish Bitcoin in the mainstream, the quicker we can have it hit that AOL CDs in the mail moment, that Hotmail moment where even your mom can start using email. The sooner we can mainstream Bitcoin so that, you know, our parents are using it, or at least holding some of their wealth into Bitcoin, because storing wealth in Bitcoin is using it, whether you know how to self-custody or not, as long as it's being reliably held. But the sooner we can get Bitcoin uptake to the point that the at least a very, very sizable minority of people now own some and are using it, the fewer chances the Klaus Schwabs of the world will have to shoot Bitcoin down and hamstring it. And we just have to. I hope for those of those people listening who have been into Bitcoin for a while, I just really want to invite you to think in terms of how can I contribute to speeding uptake, speeding adoption, because there's something everybody can do, whether it's just, getting more people to read my essay or participating in Bitcoin meetups. Talking to your friends and family, finding ways to orange pill them. It is just so important that Bitcoiners recognize the importance of individual advocacy and becoming good advocates on this topic, because again, as Clipson says so well, we are in a race, and we gotta speed things up here.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I sat on this idea for this podcast for quite a while before pulling the trigger at the start of 2023. And I'm thankful that I did, because, I mean, it's not about me. It's like, it makes me feel good having conversations like this. There's nothing more I like doing than talking to other Bitcoiners. Well, there's a few other things, but that's too much detail. I want to ask you, how has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Well, I mean, on paper or on ledger, I've gone from being pretty poor to being pretty rich. But I'm not a materialistic person. You know, it's like I don't own a car. I live 10 months a year just kind of traveling, and like I brought a backpack to Europe and that's it. Like a backpack I could fit under my airline seat. You know, I'm borrowing a few t-shirts from a friend so that I don't have to do laundry every single week. I mean, I really try to live minimalist. I've been to enough places that I've, you know, including Central America and India, where I've seen true poverty. And I don't think you get happiness from material possessions. But, you know, knowing that if I wanted to build a citadel, if I wanted to buy a sailboat, you know, if I wanted to just travel around the country in a small vehicle, you know, I could do that. And I mean, that's pretty liberating. But I mean, you know, I'm definitely at a stage in my life where I just get up in the morning and I write for a couple of hours on topics that I think matter. And my main motivation is to just help other people and to remove some of the suffering from this world. I think the ahimsa, the concept of ahimsa, I won't really get into, other than you're actively preventing violence from happening. I think that's a really noble concept. And just as you could become a very rich person in this world, you could also keep, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of beings, both human and animal, from harm. So, like, I'm very much motivated by ridding the world of suffering while recognizing that some suffering is inevitable. But, you know, it's like, I think I'm very much at the point where, hey, I have plenty of money. I've had plenty of recognition in my main career, and I don't need any more money. I don't need any more recognition. What I'm more interested in is helping people who are, you know, trying to make their mark on the world, whether that's, you know, they own a restaurant or they're doing some sort of meaningful advocacy. It's like, I'm more into, well, how can I help them? Is there something I can do that will remove an obstacle for them? And I literally try every day to do things that help people, you know, accomplish some of their dreams. And it's just a really beautiful state, you know, stage of my life to be in. Again, I also just can devote a lot of my time to just basic brain plasticity and reading eclectic material on all sorts of topics that are just interesting me at the moment. And I'm just incredibly fortunate to be in my 50s and to be, you know, in most respects healthier than I was when I was a teenager, and you know, being able to have unfettered ability to do whatever the hell I want to do. So you know, gosh, it's really fun I never thought I'd say this, you know, but it's like over the last 5-10 years, it's become actually really fun and rewarding to be alive. Whereas I think up until when I turned 50, it was just like I just perceived everything as just being this unpleasant grind.
Far out. So you've increased your optionality, and that's allowed you to be of service to the world, the people around you. That's very cool, man. Very cool.
I'm lucky as hell, and I don't take it for granted for a moment. And you know, any moment you could be gone. I was just walking up the street in Vietnam a couple of months ago, and there was a scooter accident, and I wasn't paying much attention, and I nearly stepped on what I think was a dead woman who'd been dragged to the sidewalk. And, you know, life can just be over in a heartbeat. I mean, so I think you just gotta, you gotta be really prudent about taking care of your health. You gotta be really prudent about looking both ways when you cross the street, and, you know, and not doing things that carry undue risk. Like, I would never get on a motorcycle, never, you know, because it's just like the risk reward is just like I was saying earlier about gambling. You know, it's just like I only want to do things when the odds are just remarkably in my favor, when you've got an asymmetric bet. And getting on a motorcycle is the opposite of an asymmetric bet. There is no benefit to that outweighs the 20-to-1 risk per mile of driving in an automobile.
Well, you know, I don't know if any motorcyclists enthusiasts are listening.
Oh, they hate me, but regardless,
I don't really have a thing against motorbikes, other than like it's just annoying to go anywhere because you have to put on all this stuff. And I know that some people just jump on in shorts and singlet and a pair of thongs, but I'm not that far out on the risk curve, certainly not nowadays. And just the admin involved in having to get on a motorbike to go down the shops. Yeah. And then you're restricted as to how much stuff you can bring back, which is may or may not be a good thing. But if you're trying to do the shopping, it's a pain in the bum. So I'd rather just get in the car. I think it's just a lot easier.
Yeah. I've just seen too much having visited Southeast Asia, and you know, it's just, I've just seen too much. I watched a neighbor lose all her teeth, on a moped. A couple of people I knew in high school have died on those things. But anyway, I mean, we're getting off topic, but I think, you know, the underlying theme we're talking about here is how to live your life in a really rewarding way. And the rewards stop if life runs out. So I think, do what you can to keep it going and to take minimal risks.
Totally. Yeah. You can have as much wealth as you like, but if you ain't got your health, it means nothing. It means nothing. Just get a cold and don't function on baseline for a couple of days or weeks and see how you get on, see how much you care about, how much money you got in the bank.
Yeah. If you're not having fun, you know, your life is not structured in a way that makes sense. And that gets back to what I was saying earlier. It just, there is no substitute. If your life is currently out of whack, then getting up in the morning and spending 20 minutes a day thinking about how to fix things and writing down your best ideas onto index cards.
It reminds me of Leela, actually, that practice.
Oh, person.
Yeah.
Robert, right?
Writing down those ideas on index cards, and then he'd like randomize them, and then he'd do like a random access memory where he'd pull out a card, and he was trying to put this narrative of the book together or something like that. But
oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I this is the guy who wrote the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right?
That's right. Yeah. Leela's the second, the sequel, okay. I suppose.
Okay, I hadn't gotten to that, but I mean, cool. I now I need to read Leela. So, Excellent.
Yeah, definitely, man. It's worth a read. It's one of about 20 books I've got open at the moment, and I try and, you know, get to it when I can. I haven't finished it yet, but his refutation of subject-object points of view and fitting it into a wider metaphysical way of being in the world is really fascinating. And but for the tyranny of time scarcity, I would love to really unpack it. I think Breedlove on that's how I heard of the book Breedlove on his What Is Money show, he was talking to Mike Hill about the book, and it's a cracking listen, actually. Highly recommend anyone going out and finding that.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking for something new to read because I'm just finishing Edward Chancellor's, what's it called? I think it's The Value of Time. It's by Edward Chancellor. Dave Collum, that crazy organic chemist from Cornell who writes The Years in Review, he highly recommended it. And so I went out and picked that thing up, and it is a slog, but I mean, it's beautifully written. It's not funny like Matt Levine's stuff is funny, but it's comparably insightful. And all it does is talk about interest rates and how when they are distorted, and especially when they're kept too low, it basically causes the both national and worldwide economies to grind ever increasingly out of control. Really a wonderful read. And I mentioned, you know, I read, you know, Wealth of Nations and Das Kapital in high school, but I think this was the book on macro that I've gotten the most out of. It's a challenge, but I mean, it is, if you really want to kind of level up and get to the point where you can better understand people like Tom Longo and Preston Pish and Greg Foss and Lynn Alden, if you want to get to the point where you can understand, you know, half of what they're saying instead of 10%, I think this Chancellor book is just mandatory reading.
Well, noted. I've written that down in the notes. I might actually put a couple of those books in the show notes if I remember.
Oh, please do. Please do. I'd be really grateful. In fact, I'm looking up it's called The Price of Time, not The Value of Time.
Price of Time. Okay.
And it's by Edward Chancellor. Yeah, I just finished it, and absolutely remarkable. I mean, and he somehow has brought every pithy quotation related to interest rates. There's so many interesting things that have been said over the last few centuries about interest rates. And I mean, the guy just went obsessively deep into this topic that when you really begin understanding it, you really see that interest rates run the world and govern the economy. It's like it is the measuring stick that underlies the wealth, the value of money. So, yeah, very, very good stuff. I mean, anything Dave Collum recommends, I'm generally keen to read. And he's also talk about brain plasticity. This is a guy whose interests, he's one of the great polymaths of, apart from having a degree in organic chemistry, he writes like the most intelligent, quote, conspiracy theory stuff you're ever going to encounter. So go read his Years in Review. He did one for 2022 that you could find with a little looking, and definitely follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, I usually catch the TFTC recap with Marty when Marty and Dave are on, and I try and listen to that. He's a fascinating individual, to be sure.
Oh, yeah.
What have you learned about the world and yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
Well, like I said, you know, I mean, don't let anyone tell you that, you know, like it's like just being rich changes everything. It totally does. You know, it's like I just don't have any fear anymore about, you know, running out of money. I can do whatever the hell I want. And yet at the same time, I live on less than $2,000 a month. So, I mean, nothing has changed, but everything has changed. I live the same now as I did when I had, you know, $40,000 in the bank.
And just that you're warm.
I'm warm now. I'm warm now. But I mean, I think I will always be frugal. I'm never going to be flying private or any of that. I'm never going to, you know, just gratuitously throw money away, because, you know, that could be donated to any sort of shelter that's, you know, caring for victims, and, you know, a little money goes a long way. So I'm always going to live frugally. I don't know what I've really learned about myself since Bitcoin, other than how to enjoy my life better. Oh, you know what I'll say? Actually, that is a really good question. I do have a good answer for this. What I've learned is that, like, the world of Bitcoin is full of the smartest people you're ever going to meet. And I mean, they're just like, they are so much smarter than the people who populate the field where I do most of my work. You know, I mean, the IQ is like 50 points higher among Bitcoiners than people who are really deep down the rabbit hole than people who I meet in my civilian life. And and a lot of these people are way smarter than me. But the thing I've really learned is that it's almost like that Dungeons and Dragons matrix of good, neutral, evil. You know, there's lots of smart people who are neutral and evil. And, you know, there's some pretty shitty people in the world of Bitcoin or who are affiliate scammers within Bitcoin. There's some shady characters, you know, and there's just, and I think Bitcoin actually has this incredible, uncanny way of revealing ethically compromised people. Like, if you listen to the podcasts and if you pay attention, you'll see people who are prominent within Bitcoin who have acted in some pretty shady ways, whether it's like advertising questionable services on their podcast, or, you know, promoting altcoins you know, you've just seen a lot of shady behavior. And, you know, like in one of the podcasts I listened to, just had this 4-hour podcast with a prominent guy within Bitcoin. But this guy was responsible for like promulgating shitcoins across a major platform and basically changing that platform's direction to embrace shitcoin so that the platform would get all these short-term profits. And, you know, I think he's a brilliant guy, but I feel like there are so many smart people who are ethically based in the Bitcoin world that when I see somebody is ethically compromised, I try to cut them off. I try not to follow them. I just and it's kind of raised my standards for the sort of ethics I expect from people in life and the sort of people I'm willing to interact with. And I think that's the biggest way that Bitcoin has changed me, because it's like, for reasons I really went over at length in the John Vallis podcast I did a couple months ago. I think, you know, as others have said, Bitcoin's kind of a truth machine, and it just reveals character in this way that helps you to appreciate the value of high integrity in a way you may not have up until now. And so that is the way that Bitcoin has changed me the most.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's such a cool answer. It just reveals incentives. And sometimes I guess you're incentivized to act on some shady things, and your time preference is far too high, and you know, you can get in, get out, scam them, rug pull them, fleece them, and disappear. There's been many a smart mind. One that came to mind when you were mentioning the health aspect was Trace Mayer and his Mimblewimble coin. You know, like he used to have some fantastic insights, which helped me quite a lot early doors. And that whole Mimblewimble saga, you know, he's just quietly exited stage left and never to be heard of again. And it's like, it's a brilliant way of, revealing the truth and people's incentives, you know. It's cool.
Yeah, it's a spotlight. And you know, the thing that's remarkable about Bitcoin, and John and I got into it on his show, is like if you and I make a deal and I'm going to pay you a Bitcoin, like when we do that transaction, you know for a fact, once that coin hits your signing device, once you can see it on the blockchain, you know for a fact that you are the recipient of a Bitcoin. Like, regardless of what you think of my character, regardless of whether you like me, you know that I kept my word and sent you this Bitcoin, and now you are the sole owner of this coin. So then the onus is now on you to repay me and keep your word, because I have kept my word to perfection. And that's a different kind of transaction than you have if I'm paying you in some, you know, Turkish lira that's deflating, you know, that's inflating at 12% a month. You know, it's a whole different ball of wax. And so it along with that comes, I think, it fosters a much higher degree of attention surrounding, you know, keeping your end of the bargain and maintaining your integrity.
Exactly. I got to ask, man, you're traveling, and you said you spent about 10 months or so traveling around the joint. Do you pay in Bitcoin? Do you use Bitcoin while you're going around?
Well, I don't have time. I have locked down my Bitcoin in a really sophisticated way, multi-sig, the whole bit. But I don't use Bitcoin when I travel. I didn't even use it when I went to El Salvador. But to me, you know, like, we're not at the stage. I don't really think paying in Bitcoin is important. I think what's important is orange pilling people and getting more Bitcoin into the hands of hodlers and creating more hodlers. In time, I think they're just as like you could have been really early to the internet and using it in 1993 and sending emails to the 50,000 people who were on the internet back then, you know, all of whom were like either in the military or at universities. In 1993, you might have been the, you know, super, super early to the internet. In fact, I was on the internet back then. But, you know, there's no way in the world you could have predicted the emergence of Hotmail, you know, and you know, which, you know, like back in the day, I was using Pine, which was this command line email system. It was just ridiculous. The kind of technical things you would have to do just to be able to open and send email. So like, just as there was no way in 1993 to predict that the World Wide Web would get invented, and then subsequent to that, they would figure out a way to graft a visually based email into the World Wide Web and give everybody a free account who signed up for Hotmail. I mean, that's crazy talk. And in the same way, I think what we're going to see is like the equivalent. I don't know how it's going to manifest, but eventually there's going to be some equivalent of Hotmail for Bitcoin, in that it's going to be good enough and cheap enough and easy enough that your grandma can use it. And, you know, then lo and behold, she'll be using Bitcoin, but it's not going to be by, you know, your mom is not going to be running a node. I mean, come on, it's not going to happen. Your mom is probably not going to even have to keep the 12 words safe or whatever. But I mean, I think within Bitcoin, like I love Matt Odell. I think Matt Odell is just the epitome of, again, I try not to have heroes, but he is so high integrity. But I think when he talks about about having your own keys and all that being easy, no, it's not easy. It's certainly not easy for anybody over 50 or over 60 years old. And I think it's asking way too much of people. If we think, you know, the way to hyper Bitcoinization is through, you know, billions of people running their own node, that ain't going to happen. You know, thank God for Matt Odell. And, you know, he's one, in fact, he's one of like only about five people who I urge in my essay to be paying attention to. He and Marty have done so much to push things along in the Bitcoin world.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, totally. Got a lot of time for Mr. Odell and Mr. Bent, to be fair, to be frank. As far as, I mean, it's in theory, I mean, well, in practice, it's easy. You just write down 12 words, 24 words. That is easy, right? And there's comparisons to riding bikes and driving cars and blah, blah, blah. I think the hardest thing is the actual comprehension of what those 12 words mean, what those 24 words mean, and the gravitas attached to them, that you have to secure them in such a way. That's the thing that trips a lot of people up. And you know, you can take it too far, you can not take it far enough. So I think you're right. And that's why I kind of interested in the Fedi implementations, those sort of layer three implementations that they're working on. Because you're right. I mean, you're both right. It is easy writing down 12 words on a piece of paper, no worries. But it's what you do with that piece of paper after the fact, and whether or not you're going to have it in 12 months, 5 years, 20 years, whatever. That's the thing. You still have to do the work in order to comprehend what it means to write down 12 words and why you're doing it. You know,
and you have to know that if you screw up, it's over. It's over.
Oh yeah,
if
it's done.
It's gone. There is no customer service department in Bitcoin. There is no manager to speak to. Your coins are gone if you screw it up. And so I think like self-knowledge becomes so key. We were talking earlier, why did I wrap my head around Bitcoin, you know, in the space of an hour? Because that was part of my gifts in terms of what I was born with. My brain was just naturally wired in a way, and I had enough past exposure that I was able to grok Bitcoin 10 times quicker than most people. But on the other side of the equation, I am a fuck up so many different ways. And like, and I know that too. You know why I don't fly? You know why I don't pilot planes? Because I am like so inattentive and so, you know, I have the temperament opposite of what a good sailor or a good pilot would have. And if I were flying my own plane, I would be, you know, I mean, I would misinterpret something the control tower said, and next thing you know, I'm landing on a runway where a 747 is taxiing, because I know how I am. So I leave the flying to somebody else. And, you know, you just have to know what kind of cloth you're cut from. And, you know, yeah, if your head naturally wraps around security, and you have enough of a technical background, and you can do you can implement your own multi-sig without any help, and all that, God bless. The world needs more of you, and you need to be helping people who don't have those gifts. But I think knowing the cloth you're cut from determines how you're going to custody your Bitcoin. And honestly, I really don't buy it that most people are really capable of getting out the hole punch and, you know, or the, what do you call those things? The things that you stamp into the stainless steel plates so that your Bitcoin is, so that your phrase is forever preserved. I don't think most people even have what it takes to do that and then keep the seed plate in a secure spot. I mean, you know, gosh, if you keep it in a secure spot, you know, it might be a safe or something. What's to say somebody doesn't get into that? Like, how secure are you actually keeping it? I mean, there's just, you know, to really, really get robust lifetime good custody is anything but trivial. And I think there's a lot of Bitcoiners who just, you know, do a bunch of hand waving and say, hey, just remember 12 words and you're done. No, that's not honest. You know, that's not how it is. And I don't know. I mean, it's a really big topic. Maybe one day you could do a show with, you know, with somebody sort of skeptical like me and somebody who's just hardcore tech savvy and privacy focused with, like Odell. But I just think there's more of a conversation surrounding it, because anyone who says it's too hard for a person to use is as misinformed as thinking that, you know, somebody's grandparents can be keeping their private their phrase and secure. It's there's a spectrum, and so, like, where you fit on that spectrum, it comes with self-knowledge, but it really has to begin with knowing the risks and knowing that if you screw up, it's game over.
Yeah, you got to want it, just like anything in life. You got to want it. You got to work hard to understand. You got to do the work. That's the cost of doing business. And not everyone wants it. Not everyone, whatever, can do it. I don't know. It's not as simple as just writing down 12 words. Certainly not. But then to the other extreme, it's not. You could do a Luke Dash Jr. and completely fuck it up. You know, he's one of the smartest dudes in the space, apparently. So I don't know. Apart from your, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, it just shows you. It shows you. It's a lot harder than people think. And the risks are a lot greater than people think. And, you know, kids, don't try this at home. You know, it's like if you want professional grade security, you better study and implement professional grade security. And it's all about responsibility. And if you're not cut out for it, then do what it takes to make sure that your Bitcoin is held in a secure way by people who are cut out for it.
No doubt. Exactly. And there are services like that coming online every day, which is good to see. Now, beyond writing an essay called Bitcoin Basics, Key Information for Beginners, and again, I'm going to put it in the show notes because it is a fantastic read. It's got a great pace to it. It's just beautifully written. I don't know if that's what you do as a job, but it seems like it because you're damn good at it.
Well, gosh, thank you. and it is what I do as a job. I think that I started out in life as a tech writer, but that was You know, I like explaining difficult things in a way that non-technical people can understand. And that's kind of been the heart of my career. But anyway, go on. So yes, it is. And I, by the way, I think it is something you need special expertise to do. Like writing introductions, I've done every sort of writing imaginable. I've done, and writing introductions is its own thing. Even Satoshi was talking about how hard it is to explain Bitcoin. And if it's hard for Satoshi, you know, he said there's nothing to compare it to. You know, if it's hard for Satoshi, you can really get a sense of how hard it is for just about anybody. And I think that, you know, advanced Bitcoiners, people who are, you know, like the Matt O'Dells and Lynn Aldens of the world, it's even hard. Like they're so far out into the ether that explaining the elementary stuff is, you know, probably being ultra advanced at Bitcoin past a certain point makes it even more difficult to explain the basics. You know, very, very few, you know, physics professors would make a good kindergarten teacher, perhaps.
Yeah. You got to have good bedside manner.
Yeah.
So beyond the essay that you wrote, how do you explain Bitcoin?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't explain it. I try to interest somebody in it and then get them to read my essay because, you know, that thing took me 2 months to write. You know, the choice of words and the level of refinement is better than anything I can do extemporaneously by an order of magnitude. So, I mean, I think my job in orange pilling somebody in person is to elicit sufficient interest in learning more about Bitcoin, getting them to be like, okay, I'm willing to spend an hour doing this. And then in my case, I refer them straight to my essay. But because that provides a clarity of explanation that I just cannot provide in person. And there's a reason why I took 2 months of my life to write the thing. I think that for whether you recommend my essay or something else, I think every Bitcoiner should have their one go-to reference for newbies that they will already know they're going to recommend in orange pilling people. And then they have to be good at like just talking about some of the advantages of Bitcoin in a way that kind of inspires people to learn more. You know, and if you can't really say it well, you know, the shortcut is to say, hey, you know, I've been into Bitcoin for 6 months or 6 years or whatever, and I think it's the most interesting thing I've ever encountered. I can't even begin to explain it to you. Go read this, you know, and that's all you need to do. Unless you have a relatively nuanced understanding of Bitcoin, chances are you can't explain it all that well. All you can do is say, hey, this is a bright, shiny object that's worth your attention. Read this or watch this. And whatever resource, introductory resource you think is best, just ask your friend, ask your parents to spend an hour giving that their attention, and hopefully some of them will follow through.
Beautiful, beautiful. And I will be referring your essay to people. I'll put it, as I said, third time, I'll put it in the show notes. It's okay. Just a really lovely read. And if you can be bothered to do the work, you will be rewarded. Simple as that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have not monetized that piece in any way on my site. If you go to the front page of my site, I talk about my publishing ethic and you know, I'm not even taking credit for this in any real way because I've published this under a pseudonym. So like this was as pure of an expression of giving as I could possibly do. There's really nothing in it for me. I pay my own hosting bill and I get nothing back, whether five people read it or 5 million people read it. But in 2023, starting out under a pseudonym and getting something to critical mass is just really, really difficult. So Dee, I am super grateful to you for having me on your podcast. This is only my second podcast in this incarnation under DN Comply. And I could really use the help of anybody listening to this to help spread the word about my piece because it, you know, a few thousand people have read it to date, but at this point it has not gained traction yet. And there's days where only five people read it. And I'd really like 5,000 people a day to be reading it. I think I really want this, you know, if I could just move the needle a bit in terms of Bitcoin's adoption and contribute to, you know, the Corey Clipson metaphor of being in a race and doing what it takes to speed things up so that we can win the race. That was my goal in writing this thing. And to accomplish that goal, I need your help. I need the help of your listeners.
Yeah, well, get out there and read it, team, because it's a damn fine read. So, Donald Nottingham Comply, thank you for spending your scarce time and finite energy telling us the tale of how you discovered Bitcoin. It's always fascinating and interesting to hear how people first spy and then pass through this orange filter, go down the rabbit hole, and how it's affected them, which, you know, I think, I don't know, I like hearing those stories, so that's why I started the podcast. But I appreciate you, man, spending the scarce time, finite energy with me, telling us how you discovered Bitcoin. Thank you.
What a blast. And being on your show is just another reminder to me of, you know, how cool the people in the Bitcoin community are. They're really the diametric opposition of the Ethereum crowd, aren't they?
Yeah. That's an odd bunch of folk, that one.
Well, you know, it's at the end, it's about integrity, and Bitcoin attracts the people with integrity. I am just massively grateful to you, Dee, for having me on. Discover.